Romans chapter 13. We finally got done with Romans chapter 12. Romans 13 is a continuation of the service idea. In the first part of Romans 12, first verses, Paul about our reasonable service to God. And then in the next few passages, he talks about our reasonable service to each other. In the fact that we're equally important, we're not to look down our noses at anyone in the church. And then he expands that in the latter part of the chapter 12 to talk about even our enemies and the service that we owe to them. In chapter 13, he changes directions just a little bit. This is known as the civil government chapter. I'm trying to find a wise way to say this. This is one chapter of many in the New Testament, which they're greatly. As we go through those, some of them may be due just a little bit to our culture. Very people. That's our history. We take an active interest in the government, our civil government, and sometimes we don't like what they do. And we have to be careful about that, as this chapter will tell us. But first, I want to kind of give just a little bit of a history of the culture in which Paul penned these words, because it was a little bit different than what we have experienced in our lifetimes, for sure. As I understand it, Roman citizens had a degree of protection, rights, if you will, and the Jews and the other citizens, they were basically at the whim of what the emperor wanted to do. From the beginning of the Roman occupancy, there were those Jews who wanted to fight. They were called seditionists. And probably one of the most famous is one that we read. Who was substituted for Christ? Barabbas. He was a seditionist. He was a zealot. He was a murderer, it calls him in the book. But history Romans. I don't know so much about that. But bloody insurrections that happened throughout the Roman occupation. In fact, as Paul was writing this, history tells us that the Jewish nation was preparing their final insurrection, which resulted in what? The destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. That would have been Vespasian and I forget the other one. There were two emperors who had dealt with that. Christians, as Jewish sect, that's all they were to the Romans. And then there was an emperor who came into power. Have you ever read much about Nero? Some say he was simply an administrator of an empire. But for whatever reason, his administration began to crumble, and he began to blame the Christians. Now, keeping in mind what we said just a minute ago, that the non-citizens had very little protection, if any. So when Nero decided to blame the Christians, he opened the gates on the bloodiest persecution in history. So this is the background, if you will, that we need to remember when Paul begins to write. First, and he says, that Roman tyranny. In our country today, because of our relative freedoms, we fuss and object at the drop of a hat. What if we were facing some kind of persecution, governmental persecution, like the Christians in the first century? I understand, and we'll talk about it. The civil government does not act at our instruction. We vote, but then they make decisions as to what they're going to do. So, with all this background in mind, every soul is to be in subjection. Peter echoed those words in 1 Peter 2, verses 13 through 17. Let's go ahead and do a little page turning. 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning with about verse. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of those who do right. As bond slaves for God. That sounds kind of odd coming from someone who is seeing this kind of persecution that's going on. But Paul and Peter both make it very clear. This is a command. We are to are two passages that tell us when we may object to it. Both in the book of Acts. I'm not going to turn there, but probably the most famous one is Acts 5:9, where Peter and Paul were told not to preach on the corners. And what did Peter say?
Obey God rather than men.
We must obey God rather than men. Okay. One of the interesting things that I noted in the news is I like to read the news early in the morning to see what's kind of going on in the world. In one Nordic country, I want to say that it's Finland, apparently there was a evangelistic missionary, I think he was a Lutheran, had been on a program, and he taught Paul's Paul's statement that homosexuality is immoral. That preacher has been indicted for a hate crime. That may well happen. We have to be prepared as Christians to stand up for what the Bible says, to do what God says before what man says, even if there are consequences to be had. Now, the first century Christians, they were put in a position sometimes, I think it was once a year, where they had to come and declare allegiance to the emperor. Can you imagine what happened to those who didn't pledge allegiance to Nero? The Colosseum comes to mind and all the evil things that happened there. But there were several other things that Christians did in the first to draw the ire of the Roman government. Chapter 6 in verse 1, Paul tells the Christians there, why do you take your disputes in front of evil people? Why not settle it amongst yourselves? Lawsuits is particularly thinking of. Why not let the church decide that? Well, Rome saw that as refusal to abide by their legal system. And I've already talked about the refusal to participate in ceremonies to deify the emperor. But this is philosophical, I guess. Why do you think that God instructs us to be in subjection to civil governments? They're a God-given institution, he said in the first verse. How does Biden's administration get to be a God-given institution? I'm sorry?
One has to wonder, don't
I probably shouldn't ask that question.
Well, we're all to be a subjection to somebody or something. You know, I'm subjected to Travis, and Travis is subjected to God. we all have somebody, and there's laws and rules that we have to be subjected to.
So then civil governments regard, I'm sorry, Ms. Go ahead.
God looked at a view that, perfection and doing things right, there's leeway that wrongs will happen, but he looked at the ideal of what's good.
That's true.
And changes that ideal.
That's true. True, ultimately. How about this? Let's get through verses 1 and 2 first, and then I'll go to that point. We are to be in subjection to the civil governments, and he makes it even more pointed in verse 2. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God. And they who have proposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. He's speaking to Christians there. We are to obey the laws of the land and not to resist them. But those laws have a purpose. And Paul will go on a little bit later and explain that. I think we have all seen in the last couple of years what happens when anarchy takes over. If someone doesn't like whether the police harm someone, they just go and start destroying and everything. That's anarchy. From Paul's viewpoint, what he's talking about, the purpose of civil governments is to keep law in order so that we as Christians might have the opportunity to do what? To live our Christian lives to the best possible degree of compliance with God's law as we can. That's the purpose of civil governments. Now, stop and think back to Jesus himself. Jesus dealt with civil governments almost all his life. Did he ever resist? That's right. Even when they came to arrest him, what did he do with Peter? He chastised him for wanting to use violence. Christ never disobeyed, as far as we know, a civil law that didn't cross over into God's territory. And he never resisted civil authority when it came to his own personal harm. Can we do less? Not everyone agrees with that. Ma'am? That's right. He never resisted one way or another. And he goes on to explain a little bit in verse 3, for rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Those who do evil, what context? In the context of the law the civil government puts in place. And we have to follow the same civil laws. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will be praised from the same. So, if we're driving down the road, this is a little bit of a loaded question. We're driving down the highway, and the speed limit says 70, and I'm sitting on 80. Is that a little bit of the white lie concept? That's always kind of bothered me, and I'm guilty as anybody. I don't pay much attention sometimes. particularly on I-20.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get these guys doing 90.
And what about the, this is all well and good, but some of the laws that are passing today are not really as good as society. You have laws about LGBTQ stuff and pronouns are
Well, Andy, the only thing I, the only way I can respond to that is what you just said. We are to be in subjection until what? Until I'm asked to violate God's word.
Right. We need to keep in mind on those, of course, there's God's law and there's civil law. Civil law says that all people are equal. You know, if you want to be a homosexual, you have the right to be a homosexual.
Right.
If you want to be a lesbian, you have the right to be a lesbian. You know, that's civil law. Okay. Now, I'm not going to jump up and go up and protest and wave flags and say this is wrong, it's against God's will. I'm just going to simply preach it in my life.
That's right. Teach what God's word said. And it there's no doubt in my mind that it condemns as immoral the concept of homosexuality, and I'll continue to teach that.
They're not dealing with morality, though. They're dealing with human rights.
That's right. They're dealing with human rights. Although the laws of a country ought to stand for morality, but they don't. That's true. It's interesting, since you brought that up, this is, and I get in trouble when I go on side trips, but I'm going to do it anyway. I was reading Wayne Jackson's Christian Courier little thing that even though he's passed away, his son continues to send it out. And it had a deal in there about on his Christian Courier website, he had posted an article about moral. And this person responded that she had never seen an any greater violation of the concept of Christian love. That he was homophobic, and he hated those who were homophobic. And his response was that it's odd that you call me a hater when you've just told me that you hate what I stand for. And that's, unfortunately, the viewpoint that quite a few of those of that ilk take. It's okay for them to hate, but it's not. And even though, if they knew the motive of why we taught that, the motive is that we don't hate. We hate the behavior that's immoral. And the bottom foundation of why we say that is because we value their souls, whether they believe in everlasting life or not.
We have a problem with that sometimes, even as Christians, to distinguish between the sin and the sinner.
Oh, it's big time.
We be careful.
Yeah. This goes back to the two passages. I guess I quote them over and over and over to kind of remind myself. Romans 3:23. 1 John 1:10. How many non-sinners are sitting in this room? I see no hands. And to take that one step further, my driving 75 in a 7-mile zone, that person committing homosexuality? Not in God's eyes. Sin. There's a passage, and I don't remember that, Travis may remember it, that lawlessness is sin. And we'll get to that. And you talk about spiritual law. Any spiritual violation of spiritual law is sin, no matter the degree of it, with one or two notable exceptions. But we're not.
So for me, not to be angry with people, with people who belt this stuff out and preach it and are so adamant about it, putting it out there in the news and on the TV, and it's one thing. That are wrong, but when you have what is really hard on me is not really being angry with the people who are so adamant about trying to teach my children that stuff, that garbage.
Mm-hmm.
That's very hard for me. I have a hard time. You say, you know, hate the sin, not the sinner. I understand that. It's just very difficult.
I know it's difficult.
With those, if they were just out there living that way, that's what they've chosen. But when they try to put it in our schools and force it upon our children, that's what really is hard for me to, it's hard for me to forgive those people.
Well, you got to forgive them. You don't have a choice. We'll get to forgiveness. That's one place we're going to go before we get out of problem. A lot of people misunderstand the concept of forgiveness, but we'll go to that just a little bit. The only response that I get that I can give to that, Dodd, is I agree with you. It makes me angry. There was an article this morning, in fact, about teachers, some teachers in Florida wearing T-shirts. You know, Florida passed this bill that said don't use the word gay. And
that's not the law. That's not in the law.
Right.
Don't say gay. That's what the opposition has named it. There's nothing in that bill that says that. It says they cannot indoctrinate the children from kindergarten to third grade.
That is correct.
In sexualizing these kids, and that's what the law is about. The opponents have said, don't say gay.
Yeah, they've abbreviated it. But my point was, there was a teacher that started, or several teachers, in fact, started wearing T-shirts to school that said, and I forget exactly the wording, LGBT, whatever that, LGBT, whatever, kids ought to be able to understand it. And ought to be able to understand LGBT concepts. And these teachers were wearing to teach class in. That was their response to it. Ought we to, and this is still in the concept of civil government, and there are a lot of things about this civil government thing that we're going to talk about before it's over, not just this. Whether one should serve in the army, whether one should be a policeman. There are a lot. But from our perspective, the Bible says that we have to forgive. Now, that doesn't mean that we overlook wrong and go to this premise. In the Lord's Prayer, Jesus said, or he prayed that we forgive our debtors, those who sinned against us, and God forgives us. Let me pose this question. Is that the same thing? For God to forgive sin, is that the same thing as for us to forgive sin? I do not have the authority to wipe away sin. Neither do you. So it's not the same. Greek words are both translated forgive. One is the sense of to send away. Only God has that authority. He's the only one who can send it away to be remembered no more. I don't have the authority to look at Sylvia and say, Miss Sylvia sinned and I'm not sent away. She's not God anymore. Anybody in this room have that authority? So it's not the same. So when this person gets out there, this teacher, for example, who's trying to indoctrinate the kids into some moral situation that God forbids, I don't have the right to forgive her before God. But God said, I must. So how do I forgive? That's the second concept. The second word starts with a C, and I couldn't begin to pronounce it. Chor or mazai or something like that. And it simply has to do a kindness. To extend a kindness. I don't overlook what they did wrong. That's not part of forgiveness, for us at least. It goes back to what Jesus said about do good, or what Paul said about do good to all men. How do we do that? Well, we address it. Jesus said, to whom? To everyone, even that person who makes us angry. Now, it is out here teaching our kids, I use civil law. There are ways to address it. You go to the school board. You go to the governor if you have to. You build your case that what they're doing is wrong, because your children have a right to be taught according to your philosophy, not everyone's. Social engineering has no place in schools. That's my opinion. But yet it's happening. But we get back to this idea of forgiveness. If that person, I don't know the name of a homosexual celebrity, but if there's someone out there who's living a life totally depraved, and that person has a need that I can address, must I address it? Absolutely. That's forgiveness from our point of view. That doesn't mean that person is okay with God, because I don't have that authority. Only God, Christ, have that authority. But we still see, it's like we talked about multiple times, if that homosexual person walks in the back door, what do I see? I see a soul in need of being saved.
Or being an ambassador. Christ.
Yes.
Natural human instinct would be to shun, push away, but as an ambassador, we portray the Christian attitude, hoping.
That's right. That's all part of this heaping coal on their head, the burning with shame thing. Here's this person that I ought to hate, and he's doing good to me. So, but anyway, we do have civil recourse that. We live under the civil government. We abide by those laws, and if those laws say we have civil recourse, I don't have a problem with it. But be that as it may, let's talk about one or two other things. How many of you remember the movie Sergeant York? Sergeant York.
Black and white.
Black and white. Gary Cooper. I've read, and whether there's any truth to it or not, that he was a member of the church. Now, I know in the movie they called his pastor, Walter Brennan. He was drafted during World War I. And his preacher had told him that it was wrong to kill, that God forbid the taking of a human life. So he claimed what's called conscientious objector status. I'm going to try to present both sides of the issues if I can, because there's a lot of disagreement. But Sergeant York saw a need in the battlefield, and he made a decision that I can't in good conscience stand by and see my fellow soldiers slaughtered. I have to do what I can to stop that. Which means he took German soldiers' lives. So which way's right? Can I or can I not? First, there's a little bit of a misunderstanding. Paul quotes later on, down in verse 9, I believe it is, quotes the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. One of those is, and it's, some people say the Bible, or good Christians, are taught not to kill. That's not correct. Even the Hebrew words in the Old Testament are not to murder. And that word literally had, we don't take someone's life in opposition to what the law of Moses told us to do. Later on, in fact, throughout the Old Testament, there are instances of someone's life being forfeited because of violation of the law. So when you bring that forward, it's not to murder is the word. We don't take someone's life illegally. Now, the law of Moses is no longer in effect, so it's civil law that we have to be concerned about. But what if, regardless of whether the civil law allows the taking of a life during war, etc., What if that person doesn't believe that it's right? For him, it's a sin. So conscience plays a role in it. And there's a passage that says that. If you violate your own conscience, then to you it's sin. One commentator I read took the side that no... This is a modern-day commentator, member of the church, a gospel preacher, a well-known gospel preacher, said that no Christian should ever take the life of another human being. Now, his proof was the time period between Christ or the institution of the church on that day of Pentecost up to 325 A.D. before the Council of Nicaea, that no church historian ever mentions that a Christian served in any army or any peacekeeping force, never took any life as far as history goes. And that was his proof. Now, how he knew that, I'm not sure, but that's what he said. Now, there's some of these questions that Philippians 2:12 is going to have to apply for your decision. Anybody knows what that says? That's the passage that says, work out your... Some translations say your own salvation with fear and trembling. We have to search the scriptures, and each individual has to decide what you believe to be correct. Same thing for being a policeman. Should a Christian like David Haney be a policeman, where he might well have to take someone's life? Well, absolutely.
And so to me, that would be the distinction. If somebody threatened me, I might try to harm them in some way. I may not be able to kill them, but I might try to harm them. And to me, that's just as bad if you're hurting somebody. But I didn't do it premeditated. I didn't want to hurt somebody. So to me, there's, in my head, it's a difference. I don't know if that's true.
I think it's Burton Kaufman that makes those exact same points. That and there is the two different viewpoints expressed by him and this other guy. That if the Bible does not condone, according to Burton Kaufman, the taking of a life legally, if one is a peace officer or in the army, and that's what you have to do to defend your country. Now, we're not talking about the concept of self-defense. We're talking about legal mayhem, the legal taking of a life versus not being spiritually legal at all. So that's one that you'll have to decide. One of the other things that I find difficult to do, Dodd, is that we're told to pray for the civil government. Even those who promulgate ideas and concepts and even laws that go against our spiritual teaching, which is hard to do. But yet, we as Christians, we have to understand what sin is, and that governs our lives. There's one passage that we'll get to in Romans 13 that has one of the most profound sayings in the New Testament. That's my opinion. It doesn't have to be the same for you. And it's often overlooked. Let's just go ahead and verses 9 and 10. Yes, still in chapter 13. Well, let's back up to verse 6. For because of this, being in subjection to the civil government, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. That very thing is keeping order, keeping civil order, so there's not anarchy, so we can practice our Christian responsibilities, free from fear, we hope, but not necessarily. And then he says, render to all what is due them. tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And he's talking about in the civil government. We don't like to pay taxes, but if the civil government says to that we have to pay taxes, then Christians are responsible for doing just that. We abide by the civil laws as long as it doesn't cross over and require that we violate one of God's laws. Then verse 8 is another one of those passages that even within the church there's disagreement. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. This concept of owing nothing to anyone. Well, there are some who contend just that any debt is not to be entered into, period. There are some who have the viewpoint that within this context, he's talking about the context of dealing with civil government. That the verse prior to that, you give the civil government what you owe them, taxes, custom, honor, and that you give that. You don't owe it and not give it. It's not a debt that you owe. You're doing it. So then, owe nothing except love. I hate to get into that today. How much time do we have?
They talk about the debt, even in the Old Testament. Remember, every seventh year they were to give all debts, so that's not an unscriptural thing. In fact, the Pharisees kind of messed that up, changed that around because it created hardship, because when you get close to that seventh year, the lenders were hesitant to make loans because they were going to have to cancel them.
That's right.
And so they went around that by passing laws.
I disagree with the people who say that you should not have any debt whatsoever. If you look up the Greek genesis of that word owe, it has to do with not repaying. And for Christians, that's a violation of the law. Part of their laws that govern repayment of debts. So if we have a debt, then we repay it. But it's not limited to that, in my opinion. We have a debt of love that requires that we do certain things. Just like this person who is immorally teaching our kids something different. Now, we can put a stop to that, but we owe that person what? Forgiveness in case of need. Civil governments. We owe the civil government until they cross the line of asking us to do something that's violation of God's law. We owe them custom. We owe them taxes. We owe them all those things. And the point being, we better pay that debt. Now, stop and think about unpaid debt, even in a monetary sense. If we take someone's value into our use, and it takes it away from them, and we have promised, either by signing a note or even verbally, we're going to repay this, and we don't, what have we done?
We've lied.
We've lied. We've cheated, we've stolen, all anti-love concepts that the Bible teaches that we are to have. So, and I read one preacher, it's a guy out of Florida, he's a gospel preacher in the church, and I can't remember his name. His contention is that debt, even legitimate debt, which he doesn't say not to enter into, but he said it's dangerous because now you have committed money that you don't have and you don't know for absolutely sure whether you are going to have it in the future. So this debt that you went into could possibly, unintentionally, put you in a sinful situation. He makes that lengthy argument about debt is bad. Now, he agrees that in our culture today, it's really difficult to afford anything for middle class and under, and to which we don't go into some kind of debt. Exactly.
They're doing you a favor, and you are doing them a favor. It's not just you owe something that you can't repay. I think
right.
That's the context.
So it all boils down to that one person's integrity and sensibility, I guess, too. I have to know. I have to have a realistic idea of what I can repay and what I can't. That does... Like the guy in Florida says, that does take into consideration what might happen in the future. So we have to be careful a little bit about that. The second half of verse 8, to me, it doesn't have to be to you, is one of the most profound verses in the entirety of the New Testament. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. Our denominational neighbors, many of them will say there is no law. That requires, or that infers, that somebody must do something, that there are rules by which God established, by which we have to live our lives, and faith only doesn't allow that. But the question that I would ask that you ponder on between now and next Sunday, how is love, if a law exists, how does love fulfill the entirety of the law? And if you look in Romans 8, chapter 2, it talks about the law of Christ. In Galatians 6, 2, it talks about the law of Christ. So there is a law, not the law of Moses, but Christ brought his own. Now, how is love the fulfillment of the law, the entirety of the law?
Well, if you love your neighbor, you're not going to steal from him. If you love your neighbor, you're not going to cheat from him. If you love your neighbor, you're not going to lie. There's a lot of, a lot of those things cover, because if you love your neighbor, you're not going to do. You're not going to covet. You're not going to, I don't know if that's what you're looking for, but to me, that just covers it all.
That's true. Okay, so next Sunday, what we're going to do is explore this concept. I never, ever am going to miss an opportunity to talk about Christian love. That's because of the importance of this passage. Love is the fulfillment of the law. And if you look in Webster's, Merriam-Webster Dictionary, which I did before I came, it defines love as a strong attraction, and emotional affection. Those are the first two entries. Now, the question that I would ask is Christianity a religion of reason or feelings? Which is what Webster says that love is. Okay. What does reason then demand? If there's a law, then reason demands that we know the law and we abide by it. That's what we're going to look at.
You know, dictionaries are good, but dictionaries change meaning because they change according to what the current society says.
Yes.
Be careful in using the dictionary.
Okay, before we go, I just understand that we have a command to be in subjection to the civil authorities until it violates God's commands. And if we don't, then there's condemnation attached to it.
But even then, you're still under the subjection. You don't cause a riot because...
No, we just obey God, what God said. And if God said we teach that certain things are immoral, what we're going to do. And then civil government will just have to do what they have to do. Thank you.